This is Junk Food Cinema.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Junk Food Cinema. Possibly the scariest episode we've ever done. This is, of course, the weekly...
Not really.
Well, no. Actually, we've done far scarier episodes for different reasons than covering a horror film, but we'll get into that later.
Have we ever covered a horror film before?
We've covered horror films before. We did an entire series on...
We covered a few.
You're doing that
joke.
Facetious thing.
Yeah.
I like it. This episode brought to you by Facetious, not always going over Brian's head. This is, of course, the weekly cult and exploitation filmcast right here on filmschoolrejects.com. So good, it just has to be fattening. I'm Brian, hello, and that's Cargill.
Hi.
And we are tearing through our One Junkie Summer of 1986 series.
The summer that changed everything.
Oh my God, did it. And somehow, unexpectedly, today's subject... is one of the most important in the whole idea that the summer of 86 changed things forever.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
Monumental.
No one really gives it credit for this, but this ties into our entire thesis of the summer of 86 and how the summer of 86 was the death of that, you know, glory days, that great genre era we had, beginning with, you know, Jaws and Star Wars, and then ending here in 86, just abruptly coming to a stop after the summer. But this is the movie that really ties it all together, because this is the movie that changed horror films forever. Like, this is the death of an era that Brian and I have talked about many times, and we'll talk about a little bit again today, and the beginning of a new era that would then kill horror and would also give birth to a new era of horror. So it's very, very wonderful, strange episode in which we get to talk about something that, how the fuck have we gotten this long without talking about a Jason movie?
Yeah, and this did kill horror for a while, but much like the antagonist of this film, some things just won't stay buried. And if you would like to unearth previous episodes where we talk about things like this, go to iTunes as well as Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema. So... this, you know, here at Junk Food Cinema, we've seen enough horror movies to know that any weirdo wearing a mask is never friendly. And that's something to keep in mind as we slash our way into a major horror franchise that, in 1986, sextupled its presence on screen by introducing a sixth installment. We're, of course, talking about Jason Lives, Friday the 13th, Part 6.
They thought the nightmare was dead. And buried. Jason Lives.
Happy Friday the 13th.
Friday the 13th, Part 6. Jason Lives, rated R.
Oh my gosh.
The movie that Gene Siskel called the least offensive film in the most offensive franchise ever.
I don't exactly know how to take that. I don't agree with that statement,
but it was a statement that always stuck with me.
You know why I think he's saying it's the least offensive is because... this is, well, before I leap into that, let me just say that this movie is terrifyingly important to me personally. Like, this movie means more to me than it should mean to any normal human being. This franchise is where I cut my fangs as a horror fan. Like, this is, I got the first movie I think I ever really was introduced to horror-wise was Halloween, and I liked the idea of, you know, that, like, silent Wraith type killer. And then I was like, okay, what other horror movies are out there? Watched the first Friday the 13th, wasn't hugely into it, but then the sequels and getting into the Jason era and the Jason lore, I was like, yes, that's what I want. And I scarfed down as many Friday the 13th sequels as I could possibly fit in my eye mouth, and it became my go-to franchise.
There are 12 movies in the franchise.
12. There's a 12. Dozen. There's a dirty dozen.
And the craziest thing about it, it's 12 movies. Jason only appears in 9 of them.
Is it only 9?
Yeah.
Is he out of 3 of them?
there's it depends on how you count. Okay, so let me walk back.
Oh,
the
this
word
is going to be interesting. This is going to be interesting. I like
features.
This. Oh, okay, all right.
Because he technically appears in the first one.
Yeah,
we see him.
No. That one, I'm with you. That one's we're right. ruling him out of that one. So there's one.
Okay, so he only briefly appears in the first one. The fifth one.
Yeah, I just
he's
figured
not
out.
Not in it all.
I just figured out that you're
because
right
because he's dead. And the ninth one. He dies at the beginning, and he turns out all along he's been this crazy psychic hellworm that
yes.
crawls into people.
Okay.
So it's not actually Jason. So there are 12 movies in a franchise in which the major hero, or villain hero of the franchise doesn't fucking exist.
There's something appropriate about the fact that Jason Voorhees is in 66.6% of his own movies.
It would be 75%.
What? Really?
There's 12 movies. He's in 9 of them.
Yeah, that's
75%.
That's you can't do 75% of 12 and it'd be a round number. I don't know math. What is happening? Why are we doing math on this podcast?
Why are we flunking out of college in this podcast?
We have officially entered terrifying territory.
But here's what's interesting about 6. The other interesting thing about 6 is not only is it the return of Jason after vanishing from the fifth film, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But it's the first version of the first time we see the version of Jason that everyone remembers Jason as.
Yes.
Like, because the thing is, as we said, Jason's not in the first film. His mother is the killer of the first film.
Yeah.
Jason appears in the second film, but he's wearing a sack over his head. People who see images of that film who are not intimately familiar with the franchise wouldn't even recognize that as a Friday the 13th movie.
Run from the murderous potato farmer.
The third movie is where he gets his mask, you know,
yes.
and finally he's the Jason that people know, but he's still a mortal human being. He's just this freak living out in the woods, killing camp counselors. This is still the era that that this movie sparked in which it's all slasher killers killing people. And,
yeah.
and what was really scary was a dude who wanted to kill people with some interesting weapon. But that movie itself is a gimmick because that movie's entirely about being a 3D movie.
Yes.
Like, it's entirely about the third dimension. So then you have the fourth movie, which is the first time we have a non-gimmicky movie that is Jason. And it's where Jason dies.
Yeah, it's the one where they supposedly kill him off.
Because
it's the quote-unquote final chapter.
Paramount was done making these fucking movies. They wanted nothing more to do with these fucking movies. They were embarrassed by them. They were making too much money, but they hated them. And so they kill him off, and they can't kill him off for good. And then they move into another film where we're like, we're going to start over with a new villain. And fans were so angry that it then led to this, in which we resurrect Jason and turn him into a zombie that cannot be killed. And from this moment on, this is the version of Jason that everyone remembers.
Yep.
The large, lumbering zombie character that cannot be killed, that walks around in a hockey mask. And a lot of the affectations that he gets from this movie.
Yeah. And it makes you buy into more of the punishment that he takes and keeps coming back, because he's no longer some crazy hillbilly. He is an undead wraith.
Yeah.
He is just vengeance incarnate. And you know, and I feel like, oh, by the way, Junk Food Cinema exclusive, just got this back from the lab. Cargill's right. It would actually be 75% of the movies. So just ignore anything math related that comes out of Brian's mouth. Thank you very much, boys in the lab, for putting that editorial at the end. Not necessary. But I'm glad you mentioned, where we were at this time, because to adequately discuss this film, we have to delve into where the franchise was. And
not just where the franchise was, because this is where horror movies were.
Sure.
Because the thing is up until this point, we had one truly supernatural, big baddie, and he was new, he was fresh, and that was Freddy Krueger.
Yeah.
You know, Freddy Krueger stormed onto the scene in 1984.
I don't even think they'd had a sequel yet by 86, right? I don't think the sequel came till 87 or 88.
I'm not 100% sure on when that sequel came out, but so we had him. But keep in mind, at this point, Michael Myers was still dead. He had died in the fire with Dr. Loomis. We got a third Halloween movie, which had nothing to do with Michael Myers. And at this point in 1986, Michael Myers was just a dude who was dead. And Jason was just a dude who was dead.
Mm-hmm.
And Freddy Krueger is cleaning up at the box office. And all of a sudden, now we're resurrecting this villain and bringing him back and making him supernatural, kicking off a wave of two different things that would happen as a result of this movie. But one of them that I'll talk about right now is from this point on, our villains were no longer dudes with knives. They didn't. It was not, how can I creatively kill a person with something you could find in a woodshed and have a normal dude do that? That wasn't scary anymore. We had seen that so many times. As Brian and I talked about on previous episodes, there were 31 horror movies in the summer of 1981. Like it was
in 81.
Yeah. There was almost a new slasher film every week.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And those slashers were just dudes with knives. Yep. They just, whatever their weapon was, whatever the holiday was, it was all knocking off the first Friday the 13th movie. But this movie gave us a supernatural foe and gave us, this led to the return of Michael Myers as a supernatural creature. This led to Wes Craven making movies like Shocker and people trying to find ways to bring back psychopaths and turn them into supernatural creatures. And the era of the supernatural slasher began in the summer of 86.
And it's very important to reference Season of the Witch because this movie, Friday the 13th Part 6, Jason Lives, is the last appearance of Tommy Jarvis, who is the only recurring protagonist this franchise has ever had. I mean, it's the reason the next movie in the series is called New Blood, is because they finally do away with Tommy Jarvis. But the reason I say it's important to talk about, especially Halloween and what happened with that franchise, is that the intention of this series with Tommy Jarvis, from the time he was played by Corey Feldman, was to make Tommy Jarvis the new Jason. The ending of the final chapter is there's something wrong with Corey Feldman. Like, this has messed him up. And then the ending of the fifth one, oh, wait, it wasn't really Jason. It was Roy. Serial killer mastermind, Roy. One of the worst audience flim-flams I've ever seen in my life.
You know, it's so weird that in horror history, Halloween 3 is so ill-regarded, and Friday the 13th 5 kind of gets a pass.
That's ridiculous to me.
And when you talk to true hardcore horror fans, it's flipped. Mm-hmm. Like, when you talk to film critics who are horror film critics, you talk to everyone in that group, you mention Halloween 3, instantly the words come out of their mouth, oh man, it's so underrated. It's so fucking underrated. That movie's good. And everybody will go on their own riff as to why they think people reject that movie. But this movie, this is as bad as Friday the 13th can get, and it gets bad. Mm-hmm. It gets bad.
We're talking about the fifth one now.
I'm talking about the series, period.
Oh okay.
And the low points of Friday the 13th are arguably lower than any other horror franchise.
Yeah. It's the big dog. I mean, it's the one that has the most entries. Like,
and when it gets bad, it gets really unwatchably bad. But this is the most offensive. The five is the most offensive of the bad.
Well, and it's because at its two lowest points, in my opinion, its two lowest points are both of the movies that intentionally make you think Jason is in it, but he's not actually in it. It's not a situation where, oh, you know, the audience didn't like it because all of a sudden it's a whodunit where it used to be a slasher. It's like, yeah, it is, but you also completely dupe the audience into thinking it's not a whodunit by putting the hockey mask on all the fucking marketing and putting, like, imagine if in Season of the Witch all of the pagan guys had Michael Myers masks on while they were, you know, concocting their evil plan.
You know how they could have gotten away with Season of the Witch
if it weren't for those meddling kids,
hockey masks.
If it was six more days till Friday the 13th.
Silver Shamrock.
I maintain they would have gotten away with it if it weren't for that meddling Tom Atkins. Damn you, Tom Atkins. And that's the thing, is that movie had a great story without Michael Myers.
Yeah, if it were just called Season of the Witch, everybody would remember that movie fondly as being a great entry into early 80s horror.
But what the fifth one did is it also presented an ending where, again, the idea was that the evil of Jason had been passed to a new host. They were totally going the route that the Halloween franchise wanted to go. And when it failed, like it did for Halloween, they did the exact same 180 and let's bring Jason back. And that's why this movie is so unapologetically Jason Voorhees. Why it takes so much joy in letting Jason be Jason that it's actually a fucking comedy. This movie.
Well, they hired a comedy writer.
Yes. Tom McLaughlin, who was a comedy filmmaker, a guy who had studied mime in college. Like, this is a guy who was not a horror filmmaker, but had made a horror film, a horror comedy by the name of One Dark Night, and that's kind of what got him the job directing this film. And it's funny that Paramount, even after it wanted to kill off Jason, when it saw the reaction to Friday the 13th Part 5, sent this edict down to Frank Mancuso, who was kind of the puppet master of the franchise at this point, and was like, you need to get this back on track. And so they, in order to bring Jason back, they literally rejuvenate him with a bolt of lightning.
Yeah. That they do the Frankenstein thing.
Yeah,
our character inexplicably stabs him through the chest with an iron pole that he wrenches off a gate, and then lightning strikes twice and reanimates Jason.
Yeah, and that's, you know, Tom McLaughlin was a huge fan of Gothic horror. That was his nod to it. But he also, in doing so, definitively creates the demarcation between Hillbilly Jason and Zombie Jason. And I vastly prefer Zombie Jason. Well, so much more fun.
You know, the thing is that I think in terms of quality of films, Friday the 13th 1 through 4 is far superior to 6 through 10 through 9.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that.
I would say that the only one I revisit with any regularity at all is Jason X. After 4. Like, every once in a while I'll be like, you know what, I kind of want to watch the first few Fridays again. But I never, I don't go back to 5. And this is the first time I've watched 6 in a long time. And I have a soft spot in my heart for 7. But everybody that I trust hates that movie. And I'm
coming around on that one, actually.
See, and I don't want to ruin it for myself because I have such fond memories of it. Because it plays into the same thing that I love about Creepers. You know, that whole notion of, you know, let's mix our hey, you got your psychic horror in my slasher movie. Hey, you got your slasher movie in my psychic horror.
Yeah.
I know. Let's call it Part 7. It's, you know, it's like, what if Jennifer Connelly's character from Creepers stayed at the wrong fucking camp? And I love that notion, but I know that it doesn't hold up. So
what if they sent Carrie to sleepaway camp? Boom, yeah. There you go. But I will say this, and guys, take a drink, because we can't talk about one movie in the Friday the 13th franchise without talking about a lot of the movies in the Friday the 13th franchise. Yeah. But one of the reasons I'm coming around on 7, Cargill specific to our podcast, is because when I watched it again recently, it reminded me a lot of Maniac Cop, because it's as much an action piece with a lot of amazing stunts as it is a horror film.
Oh, yeah.
So that made me kind of reevaluate my feelings on that particular entry. But yeah, and another note from the lab here, JFC exclusive, 87 was when Nightmare 3 came out. So 85, the second one was already. So they're a couple movies in by the time.
They're two movies in, but this is he's the only supernatural slasher at that point.
Exactly.
And that's what people wanted. Like, people were like, this is what we want out of our slasher films. But So this becomes a supernatural slasher. They hire a comedy writer, and he does something that changes horror forever in another way as well. Not only do a bunch of horror films knock off Friday the 13th Part 6 by making their villains, you know, zombies or unkillable, but this movie added comedy.
It added comedy, and more specifically, it added a self-referential, self-effacing wink and a nod.
Yeah.
In a way that not a lot of, I mean, there were horror parodies. I mean, those existed before Jason Lives came out, but this was different. This was something working within a horror franchise that delivered the goods that we expected from what the franchise had established, but within that, making fun of itself.
And what's weird is when you rewatch this movie now, the line of dialogue that does that.
Oh, I think there's...
No, there's several, but the first line of dialogue that does that...
Is it... Can I guess? Okay.
Is so innocuous in this day and age, you would not realize how genre-bending it was at the time.
Oh, then I may not know this one, then.
Which one are you thinking?
Is it the caretaker's line?
No.
Okay, because that one, when you said subtle, I was like, that's not subtle.
No. when they first, when the couple is driving through the woods and they're lost and they see Jason standing in the middle of the road.
It's
and the
line I opened the show with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have seen enough horror movies to know that a guy in a mask is never a good thing.
Yeah.
And that was a big deal in 1986 because when you were in a horror movie,
horror movies didn't exist.
It's like the terrible thing when you see a vampire movie or a zombie movie where everybody's like, what's going on here? And it's like, motherfucker, have you never, how do you live in a universe where horror movies don't exist? How does this happen?
It's the same thing that made Fright Night such a great vampire movie.
Yes, where Fright Night was like, okay, let's go in and deal with this. But that was kind of the gimmick of Fright Night. Fright Night was not, Fright Night's gimmick was, it was, hey, let's make vampires set in our universe. So how would you fight vampires with all this media surrounding vampires? This was the first time that somebody at a Friday the 13th movie is like, let's get out of this Friday the 13th movie as soon as possible. And that's not the last time it's mentioned.
No. And there's a line the caretaker has where he says some folks got a strange idea of entertainment, but he's literally looking right at the camera when he says that. And then there's another line by one of the counselors where she says to one of the campers, you know, some grownups think being scared is fun. So there's like all of these little moments throughout the whole movie where you can tell that they are going for that kind of tongue-in-cheek thing. I mean, this movie also has a Night of the Creeps level name game reference going on. Sheriff Garris for Mick Garris, the neighboring town of Carpenter, come on. Karloff's Grocery Store, Old Cunningham Road. There's a character in this named Sissy. There's it goes on and on. This is referential to the max.
Yeah, no. And he's gunning it. And the thing is that there's a lot of people who believe that Scream was a knockoff of a neglected, sadly ignored film from 1991 called There's No One Out There. Which is essentially a movie geek is in a cabin with a bunch of his friends and there's a killer out there and he's guiding them through the horror movie. Which, you know, was apparently if you go through the story, you find that one of the producers who originally looked at that film was Wes Craven's son. And there's a lot of questions as to whether, you know, this was ripped off or whether it was genuinely inspired outside. This predates that. This is the first time a horror film like this is truly referential. And this humor would then spin off into all of these other horror films. Freddy Krueger would become funnier and by the fourth film be just a yuck fest. This series would then spin off into the ultimately fucking ridiculous Jason Takes Manhattan. you start seeing a lot of comedy. In fact, that's what was so refreshing for some of us when Halloween 4 finally came out and Jason or Michael Myers came back and that movie just played it straight.
Yeah.
Like to the point, like when we reviewed that a while back, that movie holds up as just a great fucking slasher movie with a lot of smart stuff going on.
Yeah.
But at this time, this spun off a whole terrible era where horror got so bad and so campy that there was no saving itself until Scream came along. And then we had to endure a bunch of knockoffs of like, 5 years of just slick teen movies where teens were killing each other like they were in the early 80s before we could get around to J-horror again. Like, this movie lit the fuse on everything that went right and wrong with 80s horror and ultimately killed it.
Yeah, and I will say this. In my research, I found out that Kevin Williamson himself has admitted that this is the movie, Jason Lives, that was the inspiration for his Scream script, which, you know, it makes so much sense when you think about how ubiquitous the character of Jason has become to people all up and down this movie. I mean, it's no longer like, what's out there? Who's that? Like, everybody fucking knows who Jason is. And in fact, something that I find extremely interesting about this movie that no one else probably cares about is that it's also kind of a sci-fi movie because it plays with a timeline that is never really discussed at any point.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Throughout the rest of this franchise. But let me try and break it down as simply as I can.
This is also the movie that in order to retcon the movie, they have to break all of their other movies.
They break one very specific line from the fifth one. There is actually, we'll talk about it momentarily, but there is actually a scene that was written but never shot that kind of eloquently smooths that over. But as far as the timeline, here's what's going on. So little Tommy Jarvis, played by Corey Feldman in part four, the final chapter.
Which is 1983, right?
1985.
1985 is final chapter?
No, that's 84. 85 is the one previous. It's like literally every year we were getting a Jason movie.
Yeah.
So the fourth one in 84, the final chapter, Tommy Jarvis is 12 years old. Okay. So part five, where he's a grown-up out of the mental institution at this halfway house, takes place 8 years after that. So effectively, 1992 is where we're at for the fifth one. Okay. So then when we get to part six, that movie is either ignoring part five completely, or it's taking place shortly after part five. Now, keep in mind, this is still ostensibly 1992, maybe 1993. This town, Crystal Lake, has changed its name to Forest Green to get away from all the Jason lore, and Jason has become a legend that parents tell their children just 8 years later? I mean, one of the counselors in this movie actually makes a reference to that her parents, when she was younger, told her that Jason was like a legend of Crystal Lake. So either they are ignoring part five completely, or maybe if they're not, this might take place closer to the year fucking 2000. Because so much has happened in that eight-year period that by the time part six, which as we're discussing, came out in 1986... this is, at the very least, 1992, but it actually would make far more sense considering all that's happened if it's closer to the fucking year 2000. Not to mention the fact that Tommy Jarvis cannot be younger than 20 in this movie.
Yeah. No, he's clearly an older teen at youngest.
Yes.
He happens to be our hero from Return of the Living Dead the year previous.
Tom Matthews, who has the dubious distinction of being at least the third best actor to play Tommy Jarvis in a Friday the 13th movie. Sorry you just got edged out by Corey Feldman.
So technically, this movie set in 1986 is taking place somewhere in the 90s.
Where they listen
to 80s music and drive around in old Winnebagos.
This is an alternate timeline
where the 80s never died, cell phones never existed, and
which, how beneficial would that be for horror movies if we slip into this alternate timeline where it's the 80s forever?
And yeah, that would be...
cell phones never exist. You can never use that trope. Yes. Exactly. It's
which,
the final
by the
girl.
Way, by the way, we have not covered it yet. We will eventually. It's one of those modern great ones. If you're listening to this episode and you have not watched The Final Girl
yet, really should.
You really, really need to watch The Final Girl. It is a movie about a group of teenagers who know horror films that accidentally end up in one of their favorite horror movies, which happens to star the mother of one of the other girls. And it is a beautiful, wonderful, fun movie that is essentially Friday the 13th, part six.
It is.
I mean, that's the thing, is what the final, that's one of the reasons I want to mention it. It is essentially the movie. It says it takes place in 1986, but really it's like kind of making fun of the original second Friday, but really the rules of what they're playing by really feel more like part six.
And structurally, what I found hilarious about that movie is I can already see what the pitch was, which was, imagine Last Action Hero is a horror movie. Because structurally, it's like, these are just people who know a lot about this that are not in a horror movie in the sense that a horror movie circumstance happens in their world. They are literally transported into the movie.
Yeah.
It's so good. Yeah, highly recommend that.
And it's pure entertainment. Yeah. And it is a love letter to those sorts of people who love junk food cinema without ever... I think what works about that movie is it never panders to us.
No.
Like, it gives you everything you want out of that movie while letting you have fun with it, and it's wonderful. But getting back to Friday the 13th, part six, retcon.
Let's bring us back to the subject here. Stargrove! Okay, we're back.
Stargrove.
That's, of course, our transition music from now on.
There you go.
Cash! This movie, you know, we're talking about how funny it is. We're talking about that it's nodding. We're talking about that, you know, it's very tongue-in-cheek. But it also does things that this franchise has never really done before that are really fucking bold.
Yes.
One of the things in particular is that children are in danger.
Oh,
small
my God.
Children, not teenagers. You know, every other movie, it's the counselors are getting there first and the kids are going to show up eventually, yes. And the counselors are the ones that die. The only other time in this franchise we've even seen children are in flashback to when Jason was a child at this camp.
Now, having been a camp counselor and having been a camp counselor at a camp that had a crazy masked guy situation, true story.
What?
I will one day tell this story.
What the fucking fuck? Really?
Yeah, no, really. I had a horror movie. I lived through a horror movie scenario.
Wait, are you doing just the opening to one of the Friday sequels
no,
right now?
No, okay, no. Right. But I can just honestly curious. Say that there is that week where all the camp counselors come and you start, you know, you do some repair on the camp, you do some stuff. Yeah, everybody gets certified in archery or, firearms or whatever you're going to end up teaching during the course of the summer. And also that's where people start meeting and pairing up. So that element of the Friday movies has always made sense and always worked. But here, this happens just as the kids show up.
Yeah.
And so we have little kids being fucking chased by Jason. And it's one of those what the fucking fuck moments, because it's one of those moments that in watching these films, you realize you've never seen that before.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you're like, whoa, They're not killing kids, are they?
No.
Holy
they wouldn't,
shit.
They wouldn't
Jason's
actually
gonna fucking kill kids? Oh my God.
Right. And that's the thing too, is there's a scene where as fun as this movie is and as cheeky as it is, and you think, oh, we're all just having a good time, there's a scene where Jason stands over a little girl in her cabin and she starts praying for her own life, which is one of the darkest moments in the whole franchise. Yeah.
Well, and he did an interesting thing that ended up getting cut from the film that he's talked about, which is that you see when at the end of the movie, when the hero is getting CPR performed on him by our heroine, by our final girl, the little girl starts praying again. And when he wakes up, she looks up and mouths thank you to God. And the studio cut that because they thought that was too sentimental. And I'm sitting here looking at it. I'm like, you know, looking at because the filmmaker's always been a little kind of bitter that they cut that out. And I understand why. It's like you live in a world where a bolt of lightning can animate the zombie corpse of Jason Voorhees. But what offends you is a little girl thanking God for saving the hero.
This movie literally begins with Jason Voorhees having an honest to fucking gravy James Bond gun barrel sequence that slices us into the titles.
Oh, yeah.
But that's too far.
Yeah.
But sentimentality
God,
is too far.
The sentimentality and the God stuff is
just
pushing it.
So I know where the lines are. Thank you very much, studio.
Here's the thing I love about that, and I want to talk about that for a brief moment, is what I love about that is that ultimately plays by the rules of Friday the 13th that we all believe. Whether the series always plays by it, which it doesn't, the great thing about Friday the 13th was that the concept was that Jason was killing what he perceived to be sinners. He was killing the sinful, whether they were actually sinful or whether he perceived them to be sinful. And a little innocent girl praying to God with the only prayer she knows, which is "Now I lay me down to sleep," is as innocent as it fucking gets. And of course, she's protected from Jason. Her innocence protects her from the evil that is Jason Voorhees. And right. I love that concept. And it makes the rest of the series somewhat enjoyable. It allows you to kind of revel in the fact that Jason is taking, you know, taking out his anger on what he perceives to be the sinners of the world, which goes back to his core story that he drowned while camp counselors were off fucking and not paying attention. And so of course this little girl should be protected, and of course it can be in a universe where whether God exists in that moment or not, she believes, and that drives home why she was protected from Jason when she's literally staring at him while he's hanging over her with a fucking dripping blood machete in his hand. Like that's why without that, there's no other real reason why she lives. Like, why does Jason not kill her otherwise? That's got to be the reason. And the fact that they pulled back on that was a little weak, but
why would God need a hockey mask? I just imagine Shatner saying somewhere. But I feel like what's important about that, and what's important about Mrs. Voorhees' vengeance in the very first one, is that it actually gives utterance to something that was just unspoken in all other horror films. I mean, when you get to Scream and Randy's talking about you can't have sex, you can't do drugs, you can't drink, those things happened in horror movies previous to Friday the 13th. But Friday the 13th was the first one to really, when she says they were making love while that poor boy drowned, you understand that that's what her motivation is. And that's, you know, subsequently what motivates Jason. It becomes the harbinger. It becomes the mouthpiece for all other horror films that, you know, beyond that. And then it starts to have us reevaluating horror movies that came before that. And that sin factor becomes so great. And I just think it's really interesting that, yeah, you have these little kids who are, he's walking around in the cabin, but he's not murdering them. And that's really bold. The other really bold thing I think they do is that as much as this movie is letting Jason just be as Jason as he wants to be and having fun with that, it also introduces facets of lore to the mythology of Jason Voorhees that had never been spoken before, and actually shows that as much as Tom McLaughlin was concerned about having fun with this movie and it being a comedy, he's also very concerned about building the mythology of Jason Voorhees.
Yeah.
One of the things he does is, you know, this is the first time they come up with the plan that the only way Jason can be stopped is if he's returned to the place where he died.
His place of rest.
His place of rest. That's a ghost story rule.
Yeah.
You introduce zombie Jason and then immediately introduce a fascinating ghost story rule that honestly I think is part of the biggest part of the Friday the 13th mythos that influenced Hatchet. Like, that feels like that's the thing that comes back around with Hatchet is that, yeah, he's a crazy hillbilly, but he's also a ghost. He's a repeater. It has ghost story, you know, fundamentals as a foundation. That's what's being introduced in this, you know, arguably the silliest of the Friday the 13th movies, is still introducing new concepts to add to the mythos of Jason Voorhees.
Now, here's a real question. And this is a question for you, because, again, as you and I talked about earlier, the Friday the 13th are not my favorite series.
Sure.
There are certain ones I like. There are certain ones I revisit. But I don't love it passionately. I've never actually sat down and watched all 12 movies in a row. Is there a point...
Twice I've done that.
Where they've ever... I know you have. Is there ever a point where they really explain why his mother didn't know he was still alive after she killed to kill, you know, to get revenge for him, and then he shows up? And is there a point where they explain whether or not he actually died as a little boy, or whether he was then brought back for some reason, so he was undead? Because I was always under the impression that he was still alive, and that his mother just didn't know for some reason and assumed he was dead.
No, and see, that's the thing that zombie Jason fixes. Because if you add in the supernatural element, none of those questions matter anymore.
And see, that's the thing, is when you do that, and I feel that way, because I in order to enjoy these movies, I mean, these movies, as you said, this is a ghost story.
Yeah.
That's what this is.
Yeah.
This is the ghost story where this was the embodiment of the man with a hook for a hand.
Yes.
Except he was the man with the hockey mask and a hatchet.
Yeah, he becomes his own urban legend.
He becomes his own urban legend. But so what's interesting, and by... the reason I ask that is to play nitpicky rules lawyer.
Court is now in session. Court nitpicky in rules session. Lawyer.
Nerd lawyer.
Yes, you have the floor.
The reason why that Tommy isn't necessarily wrong in this movie, because Tommy says we need to return him to his place of rest. So he returns him to his place of rest, and Jason Voorhees does not die. Why does Jason Voorhees not die if Tommy, you know, said the things that, you know, if those rules work? Do you have to assume that, well, Tommy was an idiot and went to a bookstore and pulled out a book on the occult and just found the answer on how to kill Jason Voorhees in chapter 3?
Well, you have to remember, if I may, objection.
Hold on.
This was before Google.
That's the first question.
So you had to read a book.
But my question is was he wrong because he got the wrong info, or was he correct and Jason Voorhees didn't actually die until Tommy stabbed him to death and killed him at the end of 4? So his place of rest was not actually in the lake, but where Tommy killed him.
See, okay, this is interesting, because based on the timeline that I put forward, the weird sci-fi alternate universe, Jason's been dead for almost a decade. and has been buried in the ground for almost a decade, bothering no one, and yet still somehow becoming local legend that parents tell their kids about. It makes no sense.
Well, no, they convinced their kids that it was just a legend. That's the thing, is everyone knows the story of Jason, but parents are like, that was just a legend that never actually happened. Camp Blood isn't a thing. Camp Green Tree.
Forest Green.
And no, nothing really happened. That's not Camp Crystal Lake, and a place Crystal Lake is a myth. It doesn't actually exist. And Jason never killed anybody. That's not a real story. That's what's being passed on, that this whole generation of kids has grown up being told that it was a story, even though it's based on a movie that came out 2 years ago.
The only way the first four films work is if Jason didn't die in the water.
Right.
The only other way it works is if Mrs. Voorhees didn't know that.
Yes,
because all of the intros up until and including the fourth movie start with some guy saying, and Jason saw his mother beheaded that night. So Jason's like hanging out, watching shit, never thinking to be like, "Hey, mom, I'm still here. Just alive. FYI, I'm here. I'm alive. Just need to check in with you because I'm still breathing."
I really didn't like you for some reason. Went off to live in the woods as a hillbilly with a sack over my head.
Yeah.
But
I will still keep
you. The minute I saw you die, I decided I was going to dedicate my life to killing everybody that looked like the people that killed you.
Maybe. Ooh, that's interesting. Maybe Jason blames her for his death, and it's not until he sees her murdered that he realizes he was wrong, and then he takes up her charge, and that's why he's got her sweater and her head in his shack. I don't know. Nothing about the first four movies makes sense. That's why I think I latched on to six so much, is because it's like all bets are officially fucking off.
And unfortunately, we didn't get serious fucking Friday the 13th after that.
No. I mean,
even Friday the 13th.
Even the remake.
They're all crazy after this.
Even the remake, which I like very, very much, has a scene where Jason is peering through the trees and watches his mother get beheaded, which, by the logic we've set forward tonight, by the case made by nitpicky nerd lawyer, does not hold water. Yeah. Like, habeas corpus, show me the body of Jason Voorhees. Yeah. Bring the body to me. Habeas goddamn corpus, guys. But instead, he just watches his mother get beheaded again. It's like, where are you watching from?
So in theory, the Friday the 13th series is all about a kid who almost drowns while two people are fucking. They never find his body. His mother believes that he drowned out there while these people were fucking, killed a bunch of people. He comes back just in time to see his mother killed by the people that she was killing off, and then sets about killing people. So this great huge misunderstanding that involves a runaway kid led to the death of untold amounts of people.
Oh, I think it's more tragic than that. I think he blamed her and he decided that he was going to get his revenge on her, or basically teach her a lesson by hiding out and letting her believe he was dead. And then by the time he was finally ready to come back home was the day that she gets murdered. And that, like, it becomes more of a Lifetime movie, I think, at that point than a horror film. But you get the idea. But yeah, throw all that garbage out the fucking window when Zombie Jason is born.
Zombie Jason.
And the other thing is this. I don't think Tommy was entirely wrong, because Jason may have come back in subsequent movies because there was more money to be made in that series. But any other Jason could have easily gotten out of the chain necklace on the rock that's holding him under that water. Like, that's a pretty lame restraint. But something about that place and being underwater there kept him down there until that chain was broken in the next movie. So I don't think Tommy was entirely wrong. It didn't kill Jason, but it definitely kept him there this is a guy that takes four shotgun blasts point blank earlier in the movie and gets right up comically, by the way. I love that they literally do a thing where he shoots him, he rolls over, a second later just pops right back up. It's almost like he's fucking with him.
Yeah.
Almost like he's fucking with the sheriff, like, oh, you got me. No, I'm just kidding. And just over and over again.
Oh, you killed me. Oh, wait, I've been reanimated again.
I wanted him every time to just be like, Jason lives. Jason lives. Jason lives.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the kills for a second in this movie.
Yeah, let's, because that was actually exactly where I wanted to go, because of all the things that this director does right, and of all the things that he does interesting, and all the way he unknowingly changed the face of horror forever, why were the kills in this movie not the high point of this fucking movie?
They aren't the high point, nor is there any nudity. This is the only Friday the 13th film, which I think is what... was it Joel Siegel you said was
Gene Siskel.
Gene Siskel. I think that's what he meant when he said this was the least offensive, is that there's literally not a shred of nudity, and this is the only
one. And it has the worst simulated sex you've ever seen in a movie ever.
Yeah, it's like somebody doing aerobics on top of somebody else.
Yeah, it's really hilarious. Like, my wife was like, wait, are they supposed to be having sex? Because that's not what that looks like.
What's the opposite of a boner? Because that's what I had watching that scene. It's more of an innie. There's no nudity. The kills aren't the high point, but when the kills are done right in this movie, they're done very, very right.
When they're done wrong, they're very, very boring.
There's
a few good, like legitimately good Friday the 13th. Like to understand the point of the Friday the 13th series in the 80s, you have to understand that when I was a young teenager, Fangoria put out, when a new Friday movie came out, they would always put out a new updated list of all the kills that Jason had ever done and how he had done it. Sure. They'd have the name of the character, the name of the actor or actress who did it, what movie it appeared in, what kill number they were in that particular movie, what kill number they were total in the life of Jason Voorhees, and then how he would do it. And you'd just go down the list and you'd be just like, Jesus Christ, this is fucking inventive. They literally would, it was like they got to a point where they were just walking through a hardware store going, what hasn't he used?
Yeah.
And I know that some screenwriter had to do that at some point in time. Honey, I'm going down to True Value. Why? I'm writing. But this movie, it's like, how is he gonna, he's just gonna kill him. There's one kill in this that offends me. Like, most of them I'm fine with.
Oh, that actually offended you.
Bad it was.
Okay, yeah.
During the stupid sequence with the paintballers, have three paintballers walking together, Jason standing in front of them, he goes at them, swipes the hatchet, we cut down and just see a little swath of blood, and it's like, dude.
I'm glad that's the one that offended you, because I watched a lot of the documentary, Crystal Lake Memories, which I highly recommend. It is in-depth as fuck.
Yes.
And one of the things they talked about is how much this movie and the next movie were severely butchered by the MPAA. They went to a lot of great lengths to make that triple beheading look like, or as I call it, a tricapitation. They made it look so good with realistic fake heads that the MPAA freaked out and made them cut it down, which is why it looks so shitty.
Well, that makes me less angry at that particular scene.
It sucks, but you're
that
right.
That shot is just like, what was the whole point? That kill then becomes like, that's the thing about these movies, is they go so gratuitous and so over the top at times that you're kind of enjoying the silliness of the violence. Like, they go to such a level of ultraviolence that you cannot accept it as anything but comedy.
Yeah.
Because it's not tragedy. It's comedy.
Yeah.
And
this, more so than any other sequel, has people literally showing up to die. That's their only function in the movie.
The studio wanted extra casualties, so they actually wrote in an entire scene that looks like it's from a completely different fucking movie.
The couple that just got engaged end up getting skewered on a motorbike. Shot after the fact,
doing the one thing where you're like, oh, this is advancing the plot, we need to go talk to the sheriff.
There's nothing, like, everybody just showed everybody's function in this movie, more so than, and I know that sounds crazy, but it is different from every other movie where they're literally inventing scenarios where people just are there to die. Not everybody's at the camp. Not everybody even fucking knows about the camp. No, it doesn't matter.
They've got reasons for everybody to be wandering around the woods.
But in that same sequence with the triple decap, which sounds like something you should be able to get at Starbucks, but you can't, there is also what I call disarmy guy, where there's some... It proves, if nothing else, that Jason has a disdain for chauvinism, because as this lunatic paintballer in camo is hacking away at brush with a machete and saying how women should stay in the kitchen, Jason grabs his arm and throws him so hard that the arm actually comes off. And there's such a great shot of Jason holding the machete and then looking down at it like, oh, his arm came off. Like, I was just going to throw him in that tree and kill him, but I guess I got this now too. Like, it's almost as if Jason doesn't know his own strength.
Yeah, no, it was a...
Holy shit.
It was an interesting take on Jason first being a resurrected zombie and having some consciousness.
Yeah.
And it's one of the only moments where he appears to have any consciousness in the film whatsoever.
True.
And it's also more of that comedy.
It is. And I love what you said about True Value, because I don't know if you noticed this, but Jason seems to have risen from the grave with a pristine Home Depot tool belt. I don't know if you watch the movie closely, he pulls blades and all kinds of things out of this like professional level tool belt that is impeccable.
I was under the impression that he got that from Ron Palillo.
Was Ron Polito, by the way, we haven't even mentioned this. The first death in the movie is fucking Horseshack.
Yeah.
Who gets his heart literally punched out, which is the most graphic kill in the whole movie, and it's great. But literally, Horseshack is the first one to go in this movie. Did he get that from Ron Polito?
I think so, or Ron Polillo. I forget how he pronounces it. I was under the impression that's where he got it, because I know he gets the gloves from Tommy. Because Tommy takes off his gloves and leaves them there next to the thing. And I felt like that entire scene exists to set up Jason's new look and Jason's accessories.
Maybe so. Maybe I missed that part, but I just remember there's a shot later where it's almost the end of the movie and he's laying on the ground and he pulls like a throwing knife out of this. And it is the cleanest, most just store-bought tool belt you will ever see in your life.
No, because the first time I noticed it was and was curious about it was when he pulls out the commando-style hunting knife.
Yes, of course.
And it may have also come from the
Because nothing is over!
It may have come from the douchebag misogynist asshole. He may have had it because he's walking around. Like, who the fuck goes out into the woods to play paintball with a goddamn machete?
Yeah.
Like, who the fuck does that? Like, that's that character I would believe actually had it.
Yeah, that's the guy who's going to go off in your office. You need to keep an eye on that guy. But one of the other things I want to talk about that was written, was not shot, but it is in the novelization of the movie. If you've ever read that, which I'm sure all of you have.
Wait, now you laugh, but in the 80s, that was kind of a thing. They'd put out the novelization a month or two before the movie, and all of us teenage, you know, movie nerds would rush out and buy the novelization, read the novelization, and then go see the movies. Like, I can tell you that I am one of the few people in the world that has experienced all three versions of the film break in Gremlins 2. Because in the book, you know, in the movie, you know, of course, in the film, Hulk Hogan goes in to stop it. And in the video version, it's John Wayne who goes in to stop the Gremlins. And in the book, the writer is actually attacked by Brain and tied to a chair while the Brain starts writing the book and starts writing his manifesto. So, yes, there are people out there who have read the Friday the 13th Part 6 novelization, and let us not mock them because it was a thing.
Oh, I wasn't mocking. I seriously just don't know how many people out there have read this novelization. But if you have, you may have been introduced to a character named Elias Voorhees, who is Jason Voorhees' father.
Yep.
Which is sounds like a silly thing to add to the end of the movie. It's why they didn't do it. He comes to the cemetery because in the book, the caretaker doesn't die. And you realize that Elias is the one who's been paying to keep Jason buried instead of cremated. And his grave is right next to Pamela Voorhees. And you just, like, he's a really creepy Rasputin-looking dude. And the last shot was intended to be him just kind of looking at the camera. But the studio execs were like, well, we can't introduce this new person we're not going to do anything with. It's like, yeah, because you guys care so much about sticking to your rules, which is why Jason keeps coming back from the dead. Why this movie exists in the first place is because you're not playing by your own fucking rules. So why couldn't there have been an Elias Voorhees? But more importantly, this again points to the fact that Tom McLaughlin was very interested in building a mythology for this character.
Yeah.
And not just about the yucks. And I think that's fucking fascinating.
Yeah.
I really wish they had explored that. The other really bold thing about this movie is the music, which, again, it's Manfredini doing his Kmart Alan Silvestri impression. But it also, at the very beginning, and in no other movie do I remember them doing this, the very beginning of this movie, it samples from Dream of a Witch's Sabbath, which is a piece of classical music you guys probably remember from the beginning of The Shining, where it's really slowed down. But it's been in a lot of movies, but it's like all of a sudden, It's the only time, to my knowledge, that this classical music is used to signal the coming of Jason. It's usually just the K's and the M's and the Manfredini strings. This was really bizarre because they'd never do this again in any other movie. Not only that, but this movie's fucking soundtrack, you guys.
Oh, does this have one of the worst songs in the 80s?
Disagree. Oh. I think this is one of the greatest horror movie tie-in songs.
Oh my God,
on par with Dawkins' Dream Warriors.
No. No, that is fucking sacrilege.
No, it is true.
That is goddamn sacrilege. You take that back. Nope. You take that right back now.
Nope.
There is no way he's out there, is anywhere, is a pimple on the ass of fucking Dream Warriors.
First of all, I object, nerdy rule lawyer. It is called He's Back, the Man Behind the Mask. Everybody's back. And how much better can you get to hire someone to do a song for a horror movie than Alice goddamn Cooper, the guy whose entire persona as a performer is a fucking living horror movie? Like, it's so perfect.
His contributions to movies are not as great as he is.
I love this song so much. Like, to me, it does for me, for the Friday franchise, exactly what Dawkins' Dream Warriors does for Freddy Krueger. So I fucking love this song.
Sacrilege.
You know what? When I
Even
die,
comparing it to Dream Warriors hurts me in my soul.
When I die, Cargill, you can dig up my body and try to burn it to make sure that I can't come back. But I am going to commit this sacrilege because I think it literally is every bit as good as Dream Warriors.
I'm going to dig you up. I'm going to shove a 6-foot sub into your chest and wait for lightning to strike it and reanimate your corpse so that we can continue doing this shitty podcast.
It's funny to note, science. Oh, this from the lab as well. Meatballs are a great conductor of electricity, as it turns out.
Meatballs are a great conductor of electricity and a great conductor of sexual harassment, apparently, if you go back and rewatch Meatballs.
This is true. This is very true. What's sad about this to me is that this was the lowest grossing Friday sequel of all time.
Hold on. Let me just...
Oh, no. We're backing up. Back it up.
Backing up just a second. How weird is it that here we are in 2016 and the most offensive camp movie that we could watch that would make us cringe in terms of sexism isn't a Friday the 13th movie?
It's fucking Meatballs.
Bill Murray and Meatballs.
Crazy parallel. Guess who's in one of those sequels as well? Corey goddamn Feldman.
Goddamn right.
Ugh. So that brings us to the junk food pairing somehow.
Wait, no. Before that, go back and you can talk about Alice Cooper song.
Oh, it's amazing and I love it. And everyone should go buy the vinyl immediately because I'm sure as hell going to. This, as I was mentioning before, this is the lowest grossing of the sequels, which I think is a damn shame. But I think it's one of those things where audiences were just so fucking hurt by the previous one that they weren't ready to come back yet. But after this one, assured audiences that, no, Jason is back. He's back. The man behind the mask is back. They started coming out in droves again. And the movies get shittier and shittier shittier for the next, I don't know.
Three.
The next three,
the next
for sure.
Because I will not call Jason X shitty. Jason X.
I love Jason X.
So do I. I think it's so much fun. I think Todd Farmer actually absolutely got what that movie needed to be and brought it back and gave us a fun Jason again, which allowed them to then reboot the series.
It's the only Friday the 13th movie that exists in a vacuum that's watchable. Every other movie that tries to pretend the other movies don't exist fucking sucks. Every other movie that tries to separate itself from the timeline of the franchise or from the existence of the other movies is when they get really fucking shitty. Yeah. So yeah.
I will say that except for there's 2 minutes, maybe 3 minutes that I love about part 9. Like, absolutely love.
Oh, where he gets blown up with fucking grenades?
Oh, yeah. Well, no.
Where the FBI is called in SEAL Team 6 taking out Jason Voorhees.
Yes, and that's what's awesome about it. It's like, you have that moment where it's like, hey, you know what? We noticed that all these people keep dying in this place, and people keep talking about this undead creature wandering around. We're going to go and kill it, because that's our fucking job. It's the first time you have a slasher movie where the government's like, we're taking care of this, it's done. And then it's like, oh, it turns out he was an evil worm creature from hell. Fuck off.
Fuck you and your worms.
The rest of that movie is offensive, But dear God, the opening and like the concept that Jason, the end of the Jason Voorhees in these movies is when the government shows up and blows him the fuck up. Like, yeah. That's just it.
Yeah, you went zero dark nerdy on that. It's one of those instances where if only our intelligence agencies would talk to each other more, we could have taken out Jason Voorhees sooner
and saved how many lives from, you know, deaths, true value related deaths.
So many bucks and beauties could have been spared while they were skinny dipping. But to bring it all the way back around, Jason Goes to Hell is sort of the last gasp of that idea of Tommy Jarvis and how the evil travels from one person to the other that was never explored, and why his timeline kind of just ended with this movie. Junk food pairing, by the way. I want you to go down to Karloff's grocery and buy yourself a little bottle of Kathleen. Don't exactly know what that caretaker was drinking, but he definitely referred to the bottle as Kathleen, and I feel like this movie is going to be all the better enjoyed by what I assume is schnapps of some variety.
I don't think that was Kathleen. I was under the impression that that was a Red Fox style joke where he was talking to his dead wife.
No, because at one point he looks at the bottle and says, "Oh, Kathleen, you led me astray." So, and he says, "You'll be the death of me, but what a way to go." And that's literally before he throws the bottle. Jason stabs him with it.
Yeah.
Like he's angry about the mini bar.
That's another one of the jokes in this movie. "You'll be the death of me," and he throws the bottle, and Jason breaks the bottle and then uses the bottle to kill him.
Yeah.
And oh, what a way to go. This movie's just filled with this.
Yeah. And there's a fucking, by the way, side note, sidebar, Your Honor.
Eighth sidebar,
Your Honor. Objection. There's a fucking kid reading Sartre's No Exit in this movie.
It's hilarious.
There's a little kid reading Sartre in this movie.
I love that. I not only love that joke, I have that edition of the book right here on the shelf next to us.
Holy shit.
And I was like, holy shit. Now I can, if anybody goes, "Why do you have Sartre on your shelf? Are you being pretentious?" No. It's the book that appears in Friday the 13th, Part 6. That's the opposite
of pretension. I will give you that.
Yeah, no, I actually have that edition of the book. And I was like, wait. But that's fucking hilarious. That's really fucking funny.
It's
another great joke.
And the story you told earlier about going to a camp with it. I'm starting to think Cargill might be a Voorhees, or maybe is one of the people like Jarvis that it traveled into. I'm getting a little concerned here. So with that, I'm going to quickly and nervously end this particular episode. Thank you so much for joining us, guys. Please come back next week if I'm still alive. And if I'm not, I'm sure a meatball sub to the heart will resurrect me. Thank you very much, Jared. I guess that's the only thing I should thank him for. But thank you so much for joining us. Cargo, where can people find you on the interwebs?
At Jason Voorhees 3 on Hotmail.
One where he gets the mask.
Mass a Worm, MASSAWYRM on Twitter and Facebook.com/MassAWorm.
All right. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury or on Facebook, Facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. You can also follow this show at Junk Food Cinema. And you can like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. If you have a few extra shekels to throw into the hat, we have a Patreon account, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. Go there. Help us keep the lights on here. We really do appreciate that. We'll do a lot of bonus episodes for our patrons that no one else gets to hear. But I'm going to go ahead and end the show reminding you that in all walks of life, whether you're running for your life from a mass killer or just trying to score with the hottest counselor at camp, don't be a farthead.